We have been looking at a number of Unitarian and Universalist theologians over the past few months. We started with Universalist Hosea Ballou and his theology of universal salvation from the late 1700s. He believed that everyone goes to heaven, not just some of us, and that is true cause for deep and true happiness. We heard about William Ellery Channing, one of Unitarianism's three so-called prophets, who laid out the basic tenets of Unitarian Christianity in 1825. He articulated that we Unitarians believe in the essential goodness of humans, not original sin. Jesus is a good teacher, but not divine. God is one, not a party of three. And most importantly, reason is a tool for life, including your religious life. Sophia Lyon Foss was a practical theologian, one who lived out her philosophy of life. Most of all, she paid attention to the children and listened to their stories of religious experiences. She believed that the purpose of religious education was to guide the process of creative growth. This was so different than the traditional way, teaching the Bible stories and morals from them. The religious education materials that she developed were instrumental in the growth of Unitarianism and Universalism for several generations of children. Today, I want to focus on another Unitarian woman. Not a theologian, women weren't allowed to go to Harvard Theological College at that time, but a woman who broke with the societal norms to achieve great intellectual accomplishment, but whose life was cut short by an untimely death. She was a real-life paperbag princess. Sarah Margaret Fuller was a peer and colleague of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, and a journalist and radical. She was perhaps the first female public intellectual in North America. Margaret Fuller's father, Timothy Fuller Jr., was also her tutor. He was a staunch, old-line Unitarian rationalist, a lawyer who served four terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, then ran for but didn't win election as Massachusetts Lieutenant Governor, and finally turned into a gentleman farmer. Margaret began her strenuous studies at the age of three. Yes, at three she learned to read. Harvard-trained, Mr. Fuller instructed her in the same rigorous classical education he'd had: Latin, Greek, grammar, history, math, music, and modern languages. By the age of six, she was translating Latin. He had wanted a boy, and by Jove, his firstborn was going to be educated like the boy he had wanted. Her mother, of course, also taught her the usual things like how to sew and do the womanly household chores. She was forbidden by her father to read the then typical fare, such as etiquette books and sentimental novels. Margaret proved to be brilliant. She had many talents. Among her eventual accomplishments, she became a preeminent United States human rights advocate. She preached freedom for the enslaved African, economic rights for the poor, federal rights for Native Americans, and civil rights for all women. She was the first major U.S. foreign correspondent, spending 4 years in Europe reporting on and supporting, among other things, Italy's failed socialist revolution. She was the first literary editor of a major U.S. metropolitan newspaper, the New York Tribune. She was one of 19th century America's most highly paid public lecturers and the first editor of The Dial, which was a transcendentalist literary magazine. She was the author of 5 books and almost 350 articles, essays, and poems. She was the first woman to step in and to use Harvard University's library. The story of her literary and journalistic competence is long and complex. Her relationships with others were more difficult, though, as her social graces were scanty, it appears. Her ideas were radical. She held conversations for women, really intellectual dialogues, something not deemed seemly for women. Other radical ideas included compassion for people in prison, The negative response to all of this was one reason that she took off to Europe. There, while reporting on a civil war in Italy, she fell in love and had a child and got married, apparently in that order. It was en route back to the United States in 1850 that the ship they were on capsized just off of New York, and the little family all drowned. She was just 40. Margaret paid a high price for her accomplishments. Yes, she was brilliant, but she acquired her learning by force. Her father did not just encourage her, he compelled her to learn all this material. He was a busy lawyer and would return home each day, often quite late, enter her bedroom to wake her up with a kiss on the lips, take her to his study, and then make her recount what she had learned in her studies that day, and presumably set up the next day's plan of work. By the age of 15, her schedule included reading literary and philosophical works in four languages during a day that lasted from 5 in the morning until 11 at night. The only break in this scholarly routine was the few hours reserved for walking, singing, and playing the piano. Mr. Fuller was a tyrannical husband as well, controlling all aspects of his wife's actions. Even when he was working away from home in Washington, D.C., he was threatened by correspondence. Love from him was earned by compliance with his wishes. So Margaret complied. Margaret became so accomplished and so competitive that she was apparently insufferable to be around. She attended three schools intermittently, including a ladies' finishing school, I guess, in the hope of teaching her some social grace. According to others, it wasn't that successful. Her model, of course, of behavior was her own father, who was also known as sneering, scoffing, and arrogant. He expected her to teach her younger brothers. She remarked in an 1834 letter to a friend, "I pour ideas into the heads of the little Fullers. Much runs out." She was in her early 20s at this point. She didn't see much future for herself. What could she do? And she was depressed. But imagine her situation then when her father died suddenly of cholera in 1835 when she was 25 years old. The center of her life was gone, and she had to become the financial support for her family. She needed to find a paying job. She did some teaching. Fuller also tackled the grueling work of uniting her two souls, her male-trained intellect with her inmost personal feelings and intuitions as a woman. She wanted to become an intelligent woman rather than a woman with a man's mind. This union of mind and heart, body and intellect was hard won. To this end, she secluded herself away to mourn her father's death and at the same time to find her own life, her own self. The point of contact for her sundered soul, she said, was discovering the divine within. For her, it was at one and the same time a mystical experience and a transformation of herself into a human rights advocate. She found herself in her heart. Her first mystical experience, the first one we know about anyway, was when she was 21. Her father had forced her to attend church in Cambridge, and that would have been the Unitarian Church. The, quote, grateful and joyful tone grated on her foul mood, she wrote in her journal. And as soon as she could, she raced outside to the meditative woods outside town. There she had the first of the mystical epiphanies that came to her in times of turmoil throughout her life. As Fuller succeeded in joining head to heart through her mystical experiences, she became an advocate for human rights in America, and she called for a new humanity for her colleagues and peers, that hyper-rational Boston Unitarian elite. Fuller believed that these men did not give sufficient credence to the role of emotions in their lives. A critic of both traditional and transcendental Unitarian dogma, Fuller preached liberal religious freedom, saying, quote, I have pledged myself to nothing. God and the soul and nature are all my creed. Subdivisions are unimportant. I act for myself, but prescribe for no one else. Ralph Waldo Emerson, her friend and colleague, also railed against the ultra-rationalism of the then-current Unitarianism. In his famous Divinity School address, given in 1838, he told the graduating class, all six of them, that he wanted to hear about emotion from them in the pulpit. Describing a faulty minister, a faulty preacher, too common in his opinion, quote, he had no one word intimating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of this ministerial profession, Emerson avers, is to convert life into truth. I believe we Unitarians still struggle to find a balance between the rational and the emotional in religion. First in our worship services, and then consequently in our actions. We know we want to be touched in some way during a service, but often it's hard to articulate just what that looks like or feels like. For a long time, our social justice work was more discussion than anything else. Well, we might get around to some political advocacy, but that too is more concrete than many of us want to be bothered with. And of course, the rewards can be most unrewarding. Moving toward direct social action, like contributing to the food bank or working at the food bank, means those who do this risk having feelings about those they work with. To me, that is the essential difference between a lecture and a sermon. A preacher deals out their life, quote, pass through the fire of thought, end quote, as Emerson put it. A lecture is mere facts. A sermon adds not only a story, perhaps as example, but the preacher's feelings behind the decisions as influenced by the facts and the context. This balance between the rational and the emotional is as strong a debate among us as is whether we believe in God or not. Is there a middle ground? Where is that line in your mind, in your heart? Emerson and Fuller were friends as well as colleagues in the transcendentalist crowd. Fuller is counted among the most influential among that small group, along with Thoreau and Emerson. This was no small feat given those times. The dragons of discrimination against women and minorities that she worked to slay still have fire, though, as we are sometimes surprised to recognize. We Unitarians may not have saints, but we do recognize exemplars and great thinkers. Margaret Fuller is among the greatest of these. She made manifest Channing's exhortation to self-culture, that is, to grow, to make the best possible person of yourself. She said, the position I early was enabled to take was one of self-reliance, and were all women as sure of their wants as I was, the result would be the same. But she moved so far from how her father had started her, Alwyn the Head. Finally, she could say, quote, there is no being who can keep the key to my character. I knew I should be a pilgrim and a sojourner on earth. You like a sure place to lay your head. But as for me, such being can only find their homes in hearts. Religion, if that's how you characterize God, is in your heart, she said.